ever wonder what's really happening when you like hit the gym?
Yeah.
Today we're going to deep dive into, well, you.
Okay.
Your muscles.
Nice.
We're going all the way down to the cellular level.
Oh, wow.
With this Queen's University guide to mammalian physiology.
Right.
Really understand how these incredible machines work.
Yeah.
Get ready for some serious aha moments, especially when we get to the part about why some muscles are red and others are pale.
Yeah, it's true. Lots to unpack there. Lots more to muscle than meets the eye.
Right.
Why don't we start with the big picture?
Okay.
What we think of as a single muscle, you know, your bicep or whatever,
right,
is actually made up of bundles of individual muscle fibers.
Okay, so bundles of fibers.
Mm-hmm.
But what's a single fiber actually like?
Well, here's where it gets interesting.
Okay.
Each fiber is actually one giant muscle cell. And get this, they can have multiple nuclei.
Wow.
Like, it's not just one nucleus per cell. We're talking multiple.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and these cells are packed with even smaller units called myofibrils,
yeah,
which are the real, they're doing the real work of muscle contraction.
So we're going microscopic here. Inside the fiber, inside those myofibrils, what's going on at that level?
So picture this. You zoom in with a really powerful microscope, right? You see that these myofibrils have this distinct pattern of light and dark bands.
Okay, I'm picturing a microscopic barcode.
Yeah, kind of. And it's this organization that's really key to understanding like the whole thing, how muscles contract.
Okay, so what makes those bands?
So those bands are formed by two key proteins.
Right.
Actin, which forms thin filaments,
okay,
and myosin, which forms these thicker filaments. Mm. Imagine them like two sets of threads,
okay,
all perfectly interlaced,
wow,
running the length of the myofibril.
So it's all about how these proteins are arranged.
Exactly. And this arrangement is what sets the stage for what we call the sliding filament theory,
yeah,
which is like, that's the key to muscle contraction.
The sliding filament theory. Okay, now I'm intrigued. I always thought muscles just like bulged up when they contracted.
Yeah, that's a common misconception.
Okay.
Muscles don't actually get thicker when they contract. What happens is those actin and myosin filaments, they slide past each other. And that shortens the muscle.
So no bulging, just sliding.
Yeah. And all of this happens within a tiny, tiny unit called the sarcomere.
The sarcomere.
Mm.
That sounds that sounds important. Break that down for me.
All right. So think of the sarcomere as like the tiny engine that drives every muscle movement you make.
Wow.
It's the basic functional unit of a muscle, and it spans from one Z line to the next within the myofibril.
Okay.
And within each sarcomere is where all that filament sliding action is happening.
So if the filaments are sliding, something must be pulling them, right? Is that where myosin comes in?
Yeah, you got it. So myosin, it has these tiny little heads.
Okay.
And they can bind to actin.
Okay.
And that forms cross bridges.
So myosin latches onto actin. Then what?
This is where it gets cool.
Okay.
Powered by ATP, which is like, you know, the universal energy currency of cells.
Right.
Those myosin heads, they actually bend.
Okay.
And they pull those actin filaments inward.
Interesting.
Kind of like a microscopic tug of war.
Wow.
And this bending action, that's what we call the power stroke.
Ah, so it's not just about muscles bulging up. It's this precise, like choreographed movement happening at the microscopic level.
Exactly. And this cycle of myosin grabbing, pulling, and releasing those actin filaments, it repeats.
Okay.
And it causes the sarcomere to shorten and ultimately the whole muscle to contract.
This is blowing my mind.
Yeah.
So wait, if this cycle keeps repeating, why don't our muscles stay contracted all the time?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Because it's not just a mechanical process, right?
Right.
There's also a whole chemical dance happening, too.
Oh, okay.
So in a relaxed muscle, there are these other proteins called tropomyosin and troponin. And they actually they block myosin from binding to actin.
Interesting.
So it's like a safety mechanism to prevent constant contraction.
So the muscles are just chilling, waiting for the signal to go.
Yeah, precisely.
Okay.
And that signal comes in the form of calcium.
Wait, calcium? Isn't that for bones?
Yeah.
What does that have to do with muscles?
Calcium is absolutely essential for muscle contraction.
Really?
Yeah. So when a nerve impulse tells a muscle to contract, it triggers the release of calcium from a storage area within the muscle fiber called the sarcoplasmic reticulum.
So it's like a calcium flood.
Yeah, kind of.
What happens then?
That flood of calcium binds to troponin.
Okay.
And that causes a shape change.
Okay.
And it moves tropomyosin out of the way.
So it's like, now the party can start.
Exactly. Now, those myosin binding sites on actin, they're exposed.
Okay.
And the power stroke party can begin.
I love that analogy. So calcium is like the VIP pass that gets the muscle party started.
You got it. And without calcium, you know, there's no muscle contraction. It's as simple as that.
Wow. Okay. So we've zoomed in on a single muscle fiber. We've seen how it contracts. But how does that translate to, like, a whole muscle generating different levels of force?
Right.
Like lifting a feather versus lifting a dumbbell.
Yeah. So that's where things get even more interesting.
Okay.
Because it's not just about individual fibers contracting. It's about how many fibers are recruited and how often they're stimulated.
Okay. I'm ready for another aha moment. Walk me through it.
All right. So let's start with motor unit recruitment.
Okay.
A motor unit is a single motor neuron and all the muscle fibers it controls.
Right.
So when you need more force, right, to lift something heavy, your brain activates more motor units, which means more muscle fibers are contracting.
So it's like calling in reinforcements.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Like calling in reinforcements for a heavy lift.
So heavier object, more motor units called into action.
Got it.
Yeah.
What about the frequency of stimulation?
So think of it like this.
Okay.
Each nerve impulse to a muscle fiber causes a twitch.
Okay.
A single contraction. Mm-hmm. And the faster those impulses come, the more those twitches summate.
Okay.
Leading to a stronger and smoother contraction.
So if the signal is coming in fast and furious, the muscle really clamps down. Makes sense. But is there anything else that affects how much force a muscle can generate?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's something called the length tension relationship.
Okay.
So basically, a muscle's ability to generate force, it also depends on its starting length.
Okay.
So think about like trying to lift a heavy weight with your arm already fully extended.
Mm-hmm.
It's way harder than starting with your arm bent. Right, because the muscle is already stretched out.
Interesting.
So it's not just about the signals from the brain. The muscle's starting position matters too.
Exactly. But here's where it gets really interesting. It's not just about muscle shortening. There are actually different types of muscle contractions.
Okay, now I'm really intrigued. Tell me more.
We tend to think of muscles, you know, shortening when they contract.
Hmm.
Like when you're lifting a weight, right?
Right.
That's called an isotonic contraction, where the muscle changes length, but the tension stays, you know, pretty much constant.
Right. That's the classic like bicep curl image.
Yeah, exactly.
Comes to mind.
Exactly. But there's also something called an isometric contraction.
Okay.
Where the muscle generates tension without changing length at all.
Oh, I see. So like holding a plank position, you're not moving.
Yes.
But your muscles are definitely engaged.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. So isotonic is moving, isometric is holding steady.
Yep. And even within isotonic contractions, there are two types, concentric and lecentric.
Concentric, et cetera. Okay, those words ring a bell from like high school physics.
Yeah.
But remind me what they mean in terms of muscles.
Okay, so concentric contractions,
mm-hmm.
those are the ones we usually think of, you know?
Okay.
The muscle shortens as it contracts,
right.
Like the upward phase of a bicep curl.
Okay.
When you're lifting the weight.
Okay, so concentric is shortening. What about eccentric?
Eccentric contractions are the opposite.
Okay.
The muscle actually lengthens as it contracts.
Wait, the muscle is lengthening while contracting?
Yeah.
That seems counterintuitive.
It does, right?
How does that even work?
It's all about controlling the movement, right?
Okay.
So instead of myosin pulling actin inwards to shorten the sarcomere, it's more like myosin is acting as a brake, resisting the lengthening of the sarcomere.
So it's still generating force, but in the opposite direction.
Precisely, yeah.
That's wild.
And here's a little interesting tidbit. Eccentric contractions are actually more likely to cause muscle soreness than concentric contractions.
Ah, so those delayed onset muscle soreness or DOMS that we all love to hate after a tough workout are often due to those eccentric contractions.
That's right. Yeah, they cause these microscopic tears in the muscle fibers.
Ouch.
Which leads to that soreness as the muscle repairs and rebuilds itself.
So a little bit of soreness is a good thing as long as it's not too much.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, all this muscle action requires energy. We've talked about ATP being the fuel. But where does that fuel come from?
Great question. So muscles actually have different ways of producing ATP, which leads to different muscle fiber types.
Okay, this is where I always get a little confused. Break down those fiber types for me.
All right, so we can broadly categorize muscle fibers into two main types.
Okay.
Slow twitch and fast twitch.
So is it as simple as slow twitch for endurance and fast twitch for power?
You're on the right track, yeah.
Okay.
Slow twitch fibers, also known as type I fibers, okay, they're all about endurance. Think marathon runners.
Right.
Their leg muscles are packed with these slow twitch fibers, allowing them to run for hours.
So what makes them so good for endurance?
They're incredibly efficient at producing ATP aerobically.
Aerobically meaning with oxygen?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
They're packed with mitochondria, the powerhouses of the cell.
Right.
And have a rich blood supply to deliver all that oxygen.
Wow.
Plus, they contain myoglobin, which is a protein that actually stores oxygen.
Okay.
Right within the muscle.
So that's why some muscles appear redder than others.
Yes.
Like the dark meat and chicken.
Exactly.
It's the myoglobin giving them that color.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so that's slow twitch, the endurance specialists. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, we've got fast twitch fibers or type 2 fibers. And you said they come in two varieties, fast oxidative glycolytic, or FOG, and fast glycolytic, or FG.
Yeah, you got it. So
they both sound fast.
They do. They do. So FOG fibers are like a hybrid.
Okay.
They can use both aerobic and anaerobic pathways.
Okay.
To produce ATP.
So meaning they can use oxygen when it's available?
Yes.
But they can also function without it for like short bursts.
Exactly.
Okay.
They're like the middle distance runners of the muscle world.
So sprinters and cyclists would have a lot of FA fibers.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Then we have the chill powerhouses.
Okay.
The FG fibers.
Right.
They're purely anaerobic, meaning they don't use oxygen at all.
Okay.
They generate ATP very quickly.
Okay.
But can't sustain it for long.
So FG fibers are like the 100-meter dash sprinters of the muscle world.
Exactly.
Quick bursts of power, but then they need a break.
Exactly. And because they lack myoglobin,
okay,
they're paler in color.
Right. That's why the white meat and chicken, which comes from muscles used for like quick movements, is lighter.
That's right. Exactly.
Okay. This is making so much sense. Now, we all know muscles can get tired, but why? What's actually happening at the cellular level when our muscles fatigue?
Muscle fatigue is a fascinating phenomenon.
Yeah.
It's essentially a protective mechanism to prevent complete ATP depletion.
Okay.
And something called rigor mortis.
Rigor mortis. That sounds a bit grim.
It is. Yeah, it's the stiffening of muscles after death.
Okay.
Without ATP, the myosin heads can't detach from actin.
Okay.
And that leads to the muscles becoming locked in place.
So fatigue in living muscles is like a warning system before things get that serious.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, but what actually causes that fatigue?
There are multiple factors at play, you know. Like during intense activity,
mm-hmm,
there can be this buildup of metabolites,
okay,
like ADP,
okay,
and inorganic phosphate.
Mm-hmm.
And those interfere with the muscle's ability to produce ATP efficiently.
So it's like the muscle's exhaust system is getting clogged.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
Okay.
And then lactic acid,
right,
which is produced during anaerobic metabolism,
mm-hmm,
that also contributes to fatigue.
Okay.
It inhibits enzymes involved in ATP production and can also interfere with the communication between nerves and muscles.
So it's like a double whammy, a buildup of waste products and interference with energy production. What about glycogen depletion? I know muscles store glucose as glycogen, so does that play a role?
Absolutely. Glycogen is like the muscle's reserve fuel tank.
Okay.
When those stores run low, fatigue sets in.
Right. Think of hitting the wall during a marathon. That's often due to glycogen depletion.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we've got metabolic byproducts, lactic acid buildup, and glycogen depletion, all happening at the muscle level.
Yep.
But you mentioned something earlier about central fatigue.
Yes.
What's that all about?
Central fatigue is fascinating because it originates in the brain, not the muscles themselves.
Oh, huh.
So even if your muscles aren't completely exhausted, your brain can actually reduce the signals it sends to those muscles.
Interesting.
Causing fatigue.
So it's like the brain saying, okay, we've had enough. Let's take a break.
Exactly.
Interesting.
It's thought to be a way for the brain to protect the body from overexertion.
Okay.
And potential injury.
Wow, so fatigue is this complex interplay of factors, both in the muscles themselves and in the brain. It's amazing how our bodies are so finely tuned. But before we get too carried away with skeletal muscle, let's not forget the other unsung heroes of movement, smooth and cardiac muscle.
Excellent point. Yeah, we've been focusing on skeletal muscle, which is under voluntary control.
Right.
But smooth and cardiac muscle are essential for many involuntary functions.
Okay, so we're moving from those muscles we can flex to the ones working tirelessly behind the scenes.
Yeah.
What's the deal with smooth muscle? I know it's found in our internal organs, but what makes it different from skeletal muscle?
So smooth muscle is all about involuntary control, you know, keeping those vital internal processes running smoothly.
Right.
Think digestion, blood flow regulation, all the things we don't have to consciously think about.
Right, right.
And while it shares some similarities with skeletal muscle, it has its own unique structure and function.
So under a microscope, does smooth muscle look like skeletal muscle?
That's one of the key differences.
Okay.
Smooth muscle, it doesn't have those neat striated patterns that we saw in skeletal muscle.
Right.
It lacks sarcomeres altogether.
No sarcomere. So how does it contract?
Instead of sarcomeres, smooth muscle cells have these things called dense bodies.
Okay.
They're scattered throughout the cell, and they act like anchor points for the contractile filaments, which are arranged in more of a like chaotic diamond-like pattern instead of those perfectly aligned sarcomeres.
So it's a bit less organized, but still gets the job done.
Exactly. And now when it comes to contraction, smooth muscle still relies on calcium, just like skeletal muscle.
Right, right.
But the way calcium triggers contraction is a bit different.
Okay, walk me through it. How does calcium work in smooth muscle?
All right, so instead of troponin and tropomyosin blocking the binding sites on actin, smooth muscle has this different regulatory protein called myosin light chain, which is attached to the myosin head.
So instead of calcium moving tropomyosin out of the way, it interacts with this myosin light chain.
You got it. Yeah.
Okay.
So when calcium enters the smooth muscle cell, it binds to a protein called calmodulin.
Okay.
And this calcium calmodulin complex.
Right.
Then activates an enzyme called myosin light chain kinase.
Kinase, okay.
Which adds a phosphate group to the myosin light chain.
Kinase, phosphate group.
Hmm.
Okay, I'm remembering some of this from biology class, but what does adding a phosphate group actually do?
That phosphate group is like a switch.
Okay.
Adding it to the myosin light chain allows the myosin cross bridge to bind to actin and initiate the power stroke.
So it's a different pathway. But the end result is still that sliding filament action.
Precisely.
Okay.
Now, one of the coolest things about smooth muscle is how it gets excited to contract.
Excited? Like getting pumped up for a workout?
Not quite, no. When we talk about muscle excitation, we mean how the signal for contraction gets initiated.
Right. With skeletal muscle, it's those motor neurons sending the message from the brain.
Exactly. But smooth muscle can be excited in a couple of different ways.
Okay.
The first is through the autonomic nervous system, which controls involuntary actions like our fight or flight response and digestion.
So those are the nerves that are always working in the background, keeping things ticking along.
Precisely. But here's the really fascinating part.
Okay.
Smooth muscle can also be excited through a process called myogenic excitation.
Myogenic.
Yeah.
That sounds like it comes from within the muscle itself.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. Myogenic excitation means the muscle is self-excitable.
Wait. So smooth muscle can just decide to contract on its own? That's pretty impressive.
It is. Yeah. There are specialized smooth muscle cells that can spontaneously depolarize.
Okay.
Meaning their electrical charge changes. And this triggers a wave of contraction throughout the muscle.
So it's like a built-in pacemaker for those organs.
That's a great analogy.
Okay.
This myogenic activity is what allows organs like the digestive system to contract rhythmically and move food along without us having to think about it.
It's like a perfectly choreographed dance of muscle contractions happening all the time. So smooth muscle can be controlled by nerves, but it can also generate its own contractions.
Mm-hmm.
What about the strength of those contractions? Is it all or nothing, or can it be fine-tuned?
That's another key difference between smooth and skeletal muscle.
Okay.
Smooth muscle contraction can be graded.
Okay.
I mean, it can vary in strength, depending on how much calcium enters the cell.
So it's not just an on-off switch.
Exactly. And the autonomic nervous system can also modulate the strength and rate of contraction by releasing neurotransmitters that either excite or inhibit the muscle.
So it's a delicate balance between excitation and inhibition. Fine-tuning those smooth muscle contractions to keep things running just right. That's amazing.
Mm, it is, yeah. And this fine-tuning is crucial for things like regulating blood flow.
Right.
The smooth muscle in blood vessels needs to adjust its contraction constantly.
Okay.
To control blood pressure and direct blood flow where it's needed most.
It's like having a built-in thermostat for blood flow.
Exactly.
That's pretty cool.
So smooth muscle is really versatile. It can contract without direct nerve input, and the strength of those contractions can be adjusted to meet the body's needs. What else makes it unique?
Yeah, what else?
One final point about smooth muscle.
Okay.
Its length-tension relationship is quite different from that of skeletal muscle.
Okay, remind me, what's the length-tension relationship again?
It refers to how the force a muscle can generate changes depending on its starting length.
Right.
In skeletal muscle, there's an optimal length where maximum force can be generated.
Okay. But smooth muscle is much more adaptable.
Okay.
It can generate significant force even when stretched beyond its resting length.
So it's like a rubber band that can still pull back strongly even when stretched quite far.
That's a good way to think about it, yeah.
Okay.
This property is incredibly important for organs like the stomach, intestines, and bladder.
Right, because those organs need to expand to accommodate their contents.
Exactly.
If smooth muscle could only contract strongly at its resting length, those organs wouldn't be able to, like, empty themselves efficiently.
Exactly.
Wow, smooth muscle is truly a marvel of biological engineering. It's incredible how it's constantly working to keep our internal environment in balance.
I agree. And before we move on to cardiac muscle, I think it's worth emphasizing that smooth muscle is found throughout the body.
Okay.
Playing these critical roles in a vast array of functions.
Okay. So beyond the digestive system and blood vessels, where else can we find smooth muscle hard at work? Well, it's in the airways of our lungs, helping regulate airflow. It's in the iris of our eyes, controlling the size of our pupils.
Right. It's even in our hair follicles, causing those goosebumps when we're cold.
Exactly. Smooth muscle is truly ubiquitous and essential for maintaining homeostasis. Now, let's turn our attention to the other involuntary muscle type.
Okay.
Cardiac muscle.
Right.
The powerhouse behind our circulatory system.
Okay. I'm ready to learn about the muscle that keeps us ticking. What makes cardiac muscle so special?
Cardiac muscle is fascinating because it shares characteristics with both skeletal and smooth muscle.
So it's like a hybrid, combining the best of both worlds.
In a way, yes. Like skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle is striated, meaning it has those organized sarcomeres.
Right.
But like smooth muscle, it's involuntary, contracting rhythmically without conscious control.
Interesting. So it's got that organized structure but operates automatically. What else makes it unique?
Another key similarity with smooth muscle is that cardiac muscle cells are interconnected by gap junctions. Right. These are like tiny channels that allow electrical signals to spread rapidly from cell to cell.
So it's like a synchronized network of muscle fibers, ensuring the heart contracts as a unified pump.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
This synchronized contraction is essential for efficient blood flow.
Now, one striking feature of cardiac muscle is the duration of its action potentials, which are those electrical signals that trigger muscle contraction.
Yes.
Are they longer in cardiac muscle?
Significantly longer, yeah.
Wow.
This extended action potential ensures a prolonged contraction of the heart muscle, giving the ventricles enough time to fully eject blood with each beat.
So it's all about maximizing pumping efficiency.
Precisely. And here's another interesting parallel with smooth muscle.
Okay.
Cardiac muscle can generate its own rhythm.
Really?
Much like those specialized smooth muscle cells we discussed earlier.
So the heart has its own built-in pacemaker.
That's right. This pacemaker.
Wow.
It's located in a region of the heart called the sinoatrial node.
Okay.
It sets the heart rate and ensures those rhythmic contractions.
It's like a conductor leading the orchestra of heart muscle fibers.
A perfect analogy, yeah.
Okay.
Now, even though the heart has its own intrinsic rhythm, the autonomic nervous system can still influence heart rate and contractility.
So, like smooth muscle, cardiac muscle is subject to both excitatory and inhibitory signals from the autonomic nervous system.
Exactly. For example, the sympathetic nervous system, which kicks in during our fight or flight response, can increase heart rate and contractility, preparing us for action.
While the parasympathetic nervous system, which promotes relaxation, can slow the heart rate down.
Precisely. It's this delicate dance between these two branches of the autonomic nervous system, ensuring our hearts beat at the right pace for our current needs.
It's truly remarkable how our bodies can adapt so seamlessly. So we've covered the structure and function of skeletal, smooth, and now cardiac muscle. We've delved into their unique characteristics and how they work together to orchestrate the incredible symphony of movement that is life.
We have indeed, but before we wrap up this deep dive into muscle physiology,
okay,
there's one more fascinating topic I'd love to explore.
Okay.
Muscle metabolism.
Okay, let's talk muscle fuel. We know ATP is the key, but how do muscles actually make this stuff?
Well, just like we have different ways to power our homes, you know, muscles have different metabolic pathways to generate ATP,
right?
Each with its own advantages and drawbacks.
So no single source. It's all about the right tool for the job.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's break down those metabolic pathways. What's the simplest way for muscles to get ATP?
The simplest way is using stored ATP.
Okay.
But that only lasts for a few seconds of intense activity.
Got it. So for anything beyond a quick burst, we need other pathways to kick in.
Right. And that's where creatine phosphate comes in.
Okay.
It can rapidly replenish ATP.
Okay.
But again, only for a short duration.
Okay. So for sustained activity, we need the big guns.
Exactly. And that's where we get into aerobic and anaerobic metabolism.
Aerobic, that's the one that needs oxygen, right? Like what we use during a leisurely jog.
You got it. Yeah.
Okay.
Aerobic metabolism is the most efficient way to produce ATP.
Okay.
But it's slower.
Okay.
It occurs in the mitochondria.
Right, the cellular powerhouses.
Exactly. And it can utilize carbohydrates, fats, and even protein as fuel.
So those slow twitch fibers, the endurance specialists, they're all about aerobic metabolism.
Absolutely. They're packed with mitochondria.
Right.
And have a rich blood supply to deliver all that oxygen.
Makes sense.
They're like the marathon runners of the muscle world, steadily churning out ATP.
But what about when you need a quick burst of energy, like for a sprint or a heavy lift? Do slow twitch fibers help with that?
Not so much. That's where those fast twitch fibers come in.
Okay.
Specifically the FG fibers.
Right.
They rely on anaerobic metabolism. All right, those are the ones that produce lactic acid as a byproduct. So they're good for short bursts of intense activity, but they fatigue quickly.
Precisely.
Okay.
They're like the nitro boost in a race car.
Right.
Powerful, but short-lived.
Yeah.
And they rely primarily on glucose, which is stored in the muscles as glycogen.
So it's like they have a smaller fuel tank, but a more powerful engine.
A great way to put it.
Okay. And then we have the FOG fibers, which are kind of in between.
Right. The hybrids.
Right. The hybrids that can use both aerobic and anaerobic metabolism.
Yeah.
So they're good for activities that require both speed and endurance.
Exactly. Think soccer players.
Yeah, okay.
Or tennis players.
Right.
Who need to be able to sprint.
Yeah.
But also sustain their energy levels for a longer period.
Okay.
FOG fibers can handle those mixed demands.
So it's like they have a dual fuel system.
Yeah.
They can switch between gas and electric.
Yeah.
Depending on the situation.
A perfect analogy.
And this is what we mean by metabolic flexibility. Our muscles are incredibly adaptable, shifting between these different energy sources depending on the demands we place on them.
Precisely.
That's amazing.
It's fascinating how our bodies can seamlessly switch gears like that. So does this mean we can actually train our muscles to become more efficient at using different energy sources?
That's a great question. I've always wondered about that.
Absolutely. That's the whole basis of athletic training.
Okay.
By engaging in specific types of exercise, you can encourage your muscles to adapt and become more efficient at using certain metabolic pathways.
So if I want to run a marathon, I need to train those slow twitch fibers to become better at burning fat.
Exactly.
Okay.
And if you want to be a power lifter,
you
need to train those fast twitch fibers to become more powerful and efficient at using glucose.
This makes so much sense. I'm starting to see how understanding muscle physiology can really inform how we approach exercise and training.
It absolutely can.
Wow. Okay, I think we've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive. From the microscopic details of muscle contraction to the metabolic pathways that fuel movement, it's been an incredible journey.
I agree. It's amazing how much complexity is hidden beneath the surface of our skin.
Right.
All working together to make movement possible.
It's a reminder that we're truly remarkable machines, capable of incredible feats of strength, endurance, and precision.
And as we wrap up,
I
encourage you to keep exploring the world of muscle physiology.
Yeah.
The more you learn, the more you'll appreciate the power and resilience of your own body.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, I think it's time to wrap up this deep dive into muscle physiology. Thank you so much for joining us on this journey, exploring the incredible world within our own bodies. Until next time, keep those minds flexing, those muscles working, and never stop being curious about the world around you. All right, so we've got these different metabolic pathways, but how do they actually play out in those different muscle fiber types? Like we talked about slow twitch versus fast twitch, FEG fibers,
yeah,
all that good stuff.
Right. Yeah.
How do the pathways actually like work in those?
That's a great question because it gets to the heart of why, you know, you can train for a marathon,
right,
but not necessarily be able to bench press a heavyweight.
Right, right. Totally.
You know, they're different.
Okay, so let's connect those metabolic dots. Yeah. Where do those slow twitch fibers fit in?
Slow twitch fibers are, they're the masters of aerobic metabolism.
Okay.
Remember, they're packed with mitochondria, have that rich blood supply, all geared toward using oxygen efficiently.
Right.
To produce ATP.
So it's like they have a built-in oxygen tank and a super efficient engine for burning fuel.
Exactly.
Cool.
Yeah.
But what about when you need a quick burst of energy, like for a sprint or a heavy lift? Do slow twitch fibers help with that?
Not so much. That's where those fast twitch fibers come in.
Okay.
Specifically, the FG fibers, they rely on anaerobic metabolism.
Right, the one that doesn't need oxygen,
yep,
but produces lactic acid.
Exactly, yeah. So they're good for short bursts,
okay,
of intense activity.
But they fatigue quickly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're like the nitro boost in a race car.
Okay.
Powerful, but short-lived.
Right, okay.
And they rely primarily on glucose, which is stored in the muscles as glycogen.
So they've got like a smaller fuel tank, but a more powerful engine.
A great way to put it.
And then we have those FOG fibers, which are kind of in between.
Yeah, right in between.
The hybrids that can use both aerobic and anaerobic metabolism.
Uh-huh.
So they're good for activities that require both speed and endurance.
Exactly. Like think of soccer players or tennis players, you know.
Right, right.
Who need to be able to sprint, but also like sustain their energy levels over a longer period.
Right.
FOG fibers can handle those mixed demands.
So it's like they have a dual fuel system?
Yeah.
They can switch between gas and electric depending on the situation.
A perfect analogy.
And this is what we mean by metabolic flexibility, right?
Exact.
Our muscles are so adaptable, shifting between these different energy sources depending on the demands we place on them.
Precisely.
It's fascinating how our bodies can, like, seamlessly switch gears like that.
I know, right?
So does this mean we can actually train our muscles to become more efficient at using different energy sources?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the whole basis of athletic training.
So if I want to run a marathon, I need to train those slow twitch fibers to become better at burning fat.
Exactly.
And if I want to be a power lifter, I need to train those fast twitch fibers to become more powerful,
yeah,
and efficient in using glucose.
Exactly.
This makes so much sense. I'm starting to see how understanding muscle physiology can really inform how we approach exercise and training.
It absolutely can. Yeah, it can really help you optimize your workouts, you know?
Yeah.
Make sure you're targeting the right energy systems.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive.
Yeah.
From the microscopic details of muscle contraction to those metabolic pathways that fuel all of our movements.
Yeah, it's been a journey.
It has been an incredible journey.
It has.
It's amazing how much complexity is hidden beneath the surface of our skin,
yeah,
all working together to make movement possible.
I know. It's amazing all these things we take for granted.
Totally.
You know, yeah. Walking, running, lifting, yeah, all these complex processes happening.
It's a reminder that we are truly remarkable machines capable of incredible feats of strength, endurance, and precision.
Absolutely.
And as we wrap up, I want to, again, just thank you so much for taking us through this incredible world of muscle physiology. It's been a real treat to learn from you.
It's been my pleasure.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us for this deep dive. I hope you learned something new today about these incredible machines that we call our muscles. Keep those minds flexing, those muscles working, and never stop being curious about the world around you. We'll see you next time.